This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Why don't we start with the news of the day? First of all, good morning and welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. 888-914-9149 is the number. I tell you that every morning, but, you know, I want people to know how to reach me. 888-914-9149. News of the day out of New York. It happened after this show was over, so I wasn't able to report on it as much as I would have liked to. But that is the resignation of Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York. Now, I've got a little bit of audio for you, and this is a reaction audio in terms of what some women are saying in response to Governor Cuomo's, I thought it was a very mealy-mouthed speech that he gave, self-exonerating. I did nothing wrong. I'm here for you. I'm your friend. I just want to fight for you because I love you, and I know you love me, and I want to do the right thing. And, you know, no mention about why he's resigning. No mention of the facts that led up to his inevitable resignation.
You must have been brokenhearted when you saw that news.
Well, I mean, I don't want to take pleasure, because it would be a sin, Cyrus, to take pleasure in another person's misfortune.
But I need to go to confession.
Yeah, well, you know, and honestly, I do make an honest effort to avoid committing that sin. I try to make an honest effort to avoid committing sin in general. But with regard to this one, I can't help but feel somewhat satisfied that a guy who has done, I mean, never mind even the things that he's being accused of in this now lawsuit, 11 women and all the stuff that they're accusing him of doing. I mean, let alone that, but I mean, he's been at the forefront of pushing abortion on New Yorkers. You may remember, Cyrus, it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, when he essentially said to New Yorkers, if you're pro-life, we don't want you here. You're not really welcome here. You're not part of our New York values.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm trying to avoid, you know, the sin of taking pleasure in another's misfortune. So I'm just going to temper that by saying I'm not displeased to see this take place.
Okay.
I'm not displeased. So we don't have to go through all the rigmarole. I mean, that's out there. I thought his speech was ridiculous and self-exonerating, but he's going to be gone soon. He said, I'll be resigning effectively 14 days from now. Why wait 14 days? Bounce. Go. There's already your lieutenant governor waiting in the wings to take over. You don't need 14 days to transition. What is there to transition? You know, time to go. Anyway, he's going to wait another few days, 14 days from the time he made that announcement yesterday. But we do have some reaction audio, I believe, Cyrus. This is from CNN, if I'm not mistaken, right? This is Deborah Katz. She's an attorney for the governor. I'm sorry, for the accuser. Well, one of the accusers.
Yeah, that's right. And apparently she's involved in a few of the major Me Too movement lawsuits.
Not just against him.
That's right. Some of the big name profiles. I think she gets into that in a little bit of this audio here.
Okay. So we have an audio 3 to 4 minutes long, but it's a reaction from yesterday afternoon. Deborah Katz, attorney for New York Governor accuser Charlotte Bennett, about his announcement, the announcement of his resignation.
What does this resignation mean to your client, Charlotte Bennett?
What it means is when you finally have transparency, there can be accountability. And after the Attorney General's report came out, which was very detailed and was carefully done, the governor had no choice but to sit down because he could no longer deny how serious and inappropriate his conduct was. He lost allies. He had no choice.
But even as the governor resigned, and you saw this, you heard it, he tried to undermine his accusers, tried to portray himself as a leader on diversity and women's rights. What message does that send to anyone facing sexual harassment in the workplace?
I think that for those who are facing sexual harassment in the workplace, they would have to look at this and see that when women come together and they support one another, which is what happened here, Charlotte supported Lindsay. Courage begets courage. After she came forward, other women came forward. And I think the takeaway here is when the governor denied that he had engaged in behavior that others knew he had engaged in because he had done it to them, they came forward. We are in a moment where women are not going to sit idly by and allow perpetrators like the governor to normalize the conduct and continue to put blame on the victims and say he was misunderstood. So this is a powerful day for women.
As you know, Deborah, the governor still faces the possibility of impeachment in Albany, certainly faces the possibility of criminal charges, civil charges. Beyond this resignation, what does accountability look like, both for the governor and the staffers who enabled him?
Well, they clearly violated the law. I think all options are on the table. There are four jurisdictions that are looking at criminal charges. What is so pernicious about what the governor did today is he started the press conference by saying he did nothing wrong, the investigators were biased, and he did cast aspersions and on the motives and the credibility of the complainants. And that's just simply wrong. I think anybody who reads the report, anybody who looks at the detailed and credible notes and text messages and emails that my client and others send can reach only one conclusion, which is that the governor did exactly what the investigators found. And this is really an important roadmap about how we actually investigate high-level, powerful people, which hasn't been done in other cases where serious allegations like this have been made. He said, wait for the investigation. As soon as we did and the complainants participated, he said the investigators are biased, but that had no water. That was a silly argument.
Deborah, I know you've represented some important figures in the Me Too movement, from an employee at Harvey Weinstein's company to Christine Blasey Ford. What does all this say about how the movement has evolved over these past few years?
It says that the Me Too movement is about more than just toppling powerful men who've engaged in bad behavior. Institutions need to change. After the governor signed the most protective piece of legislation in the country, broadening protection for women from sexual harassment, the next few days he went and sexually harassed people. So what we know is that simply changing laws and toppling men like Cuomo, it's important to have accountability, but that is not enough. Our society needs to change. And today, victims of sexual harassment and survivors everywhere can look at this and say, we can come forward, we can be listened to, we will be heard, we will be credited. And that's what today is about.
All right. Fair enough. So we'll see what happens in the process. Now, there's a fellow by the name of Trevor Noah, and I only know of him. I think I've seen his picture before. He's, I guess, kind of a comedian. He's on the, what show is he on? He's a late night host now. And he, as is being described in the New York Post this morning, he's being mercilessly mocked for turning against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo not long after repeatedly declaring himself a Cuomosexual. And I had never heard the term Cuomosexual before. I heard the video of Trevor Noah saying that, bragging about how his Tinder profile includes that. I've never heard of that before, Cyrus. Have you? Cuomosexual?
Nope. Hopefully that's the last time we ever hear it.
Well, probably in the next minute or two, it won't be. But after that, maybe it'll be the last. I was thinking about this. Maybe that's what the plus means in the LGBTQ. I'm trying to remember all the letters. LGBTQ plus. Because the plus, I assume, I've never really known. It's like a placeholder for whatever we think of next or whatever the next thing
I
is.
Think that's exactly what the plus is for.
So that could stand for Cuomosexuals. And he outed himself, Trevor Noah. Now, the backstory is he was talking about how great Governor Cuomo is in this earlier video that he did. And then, of course, with the fall of Governor Cuomo yesterday, he came out against him. Is this you? Asked Accuracy in Media. It's a website exposing media bias. They posted that on social media to him saying, this you? Because of his previous confession. One widely shared clip from April of last year showed Noah, not the biblical Noah, this guy, Trevor Noah, calling Cuomo the one governor who's crushing it the most right now. And in retrospect, that might have a different meaning. But in any case, so he that didn't age well in terms of social media. But we now, I think we now have a good theory as to why the plus is there, Cyrus? I think that's something we should keep in mind.
Consider case closed.
Yeah. Now, totally different from that, completely unrelated. I'm happy to be off of that story. Two stories that are not related, but they're interesting if you ask me. And the first one, which is not a funny topic at all. It has to do with alcoholism. In Popular Science, there's some new research that they published from the University of Vermont, in which in the study they've identified eye colors as indicators for alcoholism. Check this out. People with light-colored eyes, especially those with blue eyes, have higher incidence of alcohol dependency or alcoholism than their darker-eyed peers. Now, this doesn't mean, as they're at pains to point out, this doesn't mean that there's a causation here. It doesn't mean that because you have blue eyes or lighter-colored eyes that therefore you will be alcoholic. It doesn't say that. They're just saying there seems to be some kind of correlation between the two. The study authors very likely uncovered an uncanny correlation. It doesn't provide any big help in diagnosing alcoholism or understanding the complex genetics behind it. But in the study, published in the American Journal of Medical Genetics, Neuropsychiatric Genetics, Part B, I never heard of that magazine. I've never subscribed to that magazine. Have you, Cyrus? American Journal of Medical Genetics, Neuropsychiatric Genetics, Part B?
You don't subscribe to that?
Well, I mean, I don't remember reading that.
Oh, man, that's up there with Times and
okay.
That's a classic.
Times?
I don't know. The New York Post.
Time, maybe?
All right, there you go.
Not Mad Magazine. My parents would never let me read that when I was a kid.
They would not let me read.
Well, I guess, maybe. But they just said, you're not allowed to read that. There's bad stuff in there. So I never did.
They were right.
I mean, when I got older. Anyway, let's get back to this, please. But that was my fault. So they used a database of over 10,000 patients from all over the Northeast United States who had been diagnosed with at least one psychiatric illness, such as alcoholism. The researchers noticed that of European Americans, those with lighter eye colors were diagnosed with alcoholism more often than those with darker eyes. Almost every disease we know has a genetic component, and alcoholism is no exception. Researchers are finally starting to suss out, that's a great term, they're starting to suss out which genes are connected to which diseases, but it's not an easy task. The handful of genes that have been connected with alcoholism over the last 20 years, quote, and this is a quote from the study, can only explain a small percentage of the genetics part that has been suggested. A large number is still missing. It's still unknown. Several genes determine a person's eye color, and there's a very remote chance that one of them is in some way tied to alcoholism. But for the majority of illnesses, our genes only give us a predisposition toward diseases affected by environmental factors. And for a disease like alcoholism, there are a huge number of non-genetic factors that can influence how and why people drink, such as social or cultural attitudes, income level, upbringing, and stress. So they say while eye color may correlate with alcoholism, no one is quite sure of the cause of this condition. So just food for thought. Now, unrelated to that, but in the news coincidentally yesterday, PepsiCo and Boston Beer Company are teaming up to create, you ready for this, Cyrus? An alcoholic version of Mountain Dew.
Ugh, yuck. Ugh, gross.
I mean, as if they took something. I mean, I know it's wildly popular. The kids love the Mountain Dew. I don't know that I've ever had one. You know, I was more of a root beer and Coke kind of guy. I liked 7-Up. But in any case, it's going to be called Hard Mountain Dew. It's expected to hit shelves in early 2022. This is from Fox 5 New York. Boston Beer will develop and produce the drink while Pepsi creates a new entity to sell, deliver, and market the beverage. Adults of legal drinking age can enjoy the bold flavors of original Mountain Dew.
Is that what they call it?
Sounds like a wine or something. Ugh. It has a rich aroma and a sugary finish. Let's see. Adults of legal age, blah, 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 blah. Bold flavors, blah, blah, blah. Oh, so there'll be original Mountain Dew, the alcoholic version, a black cherry Mountain Dew, alcoholic version, and a watermelon Mountain Dew, alcoholic version. Zero sugar. The new flavored malt beverage will contain 5% alcohol by volume. So, Cyrus, when your kids say to you, you know, like in summer of 2022, hey, Dad, we're just going to go down to the store and get a six-pack of
get a big gulp.
Mountain Dew.
big gulp of alcoholic Mountain Dew.
Ugh. Mountain Dew. Oh.
Yuck.
You know, and I know we're probably offending the sensibilities of all the people out there who like Mountain Dew, so I don't mean to do that. The beer business, this article says, is struggling even though alcohol consumption during the coronavirus increased. The beer business has been struggling. The United States overall beer volume declined 2.8%, even with the total alcohol consumption increasing to its highest rate in nearly two decades, according to industry tracker IWSR.
How does that math work out?
I guess people are switching. Those who drink are probably switching from beer at least 2.8% of the time and going for something different. And who knows? I mean, if with this alcoholic Mountain Dew out there, beer sales could slide even further.
No kidding. Yep. Yeah, because no one's buying this stuff.
I have another liquid-related story for you.
Okay, let's do it.
We're going to go down to Alabama. Firefighters rescued a woman last week who was found swimming. You know those big, gigantic water towers that they have in municipalities? It's their water supply. She was swimming in one of those. It was a 70-foot-high water tank.
What?
I know. It just the headline caught my eye in the first place. 350,000-gallon tank was drained and sanitized after the woman was found swimming inside. So an unidentified woman broke a fence barrier, and this is in the little town of Athens, Alabama. She climbed the ladder to the top of the tank, which was filled with roughly 350,000 gallons of water. The hatch of the tank was apparently not secure, and it shut behind her after she went inside. Now, I'm assuming, Cyrus, that the interior of a 350,000-gallon water tank, 70 feet in the sky, must be dark. I'm assuming that it would be dark in there. I don't imagine that they have lights inside those tanks. You know what I'm saying? So picture yourself, you just want to go for a little dip, that's all, and you slip into this 350,000-gallon dark water tank. Nobody knows you're up there, apparently, and the hatch closes behind you.
Sounds like the start of a good horror movie.
Oh, my gosh. Stephen King could have written this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thankfully, the woman was spotted by Doug Duran, a retired Athens police officer who happened to live across the street from the tank. Athens firefighters, they give the names of all the people involved. They climbed the tank. They found the woman sitting inside. Where would you sit? I mean, do they have like benches inside these tanks? I never thought about that. She was sitting inside. They managed to persuade her to leave the tank. They used a harness to bring her down safely. The woman was set to undergo a mental health evaluation, according to the Athens police chief, who thanked the neighbors for seeing what had happened. They said if they hadn't seen her go in, if this particular neighbor hadn't seen her go in, he puts it, there would have been a very different outcome. So Jimmy Junkin, that's his actual last name, Junkin. I wonder if he should open a donut shop. His last name is spelled J-U-N-K-I-N. Junkin Donut.
Focus.
I'm telling you right now, if I had that last name, I would open a donut shop. Dunkin' Donuts.
So
that's
this lady,
his last name.
So this lady swimming in drinking water. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. Now, poor thing. I don't know what would cause anyone. It must be a mental health issue. I can't imagine anybody who's, you know.
Or it was just really hot that day.
Yeah, but there are other ways to cool off than climbing 70 feet into a dark water tank. It just that whole part I find very disturbing. But I feel sad for this woman. I'm glad that she's safe. I'm glad that they're getting her a mental health evaluation because it sounds to me like that's what was going on. But there's now some cost involved because getting back to Jimmy Junkin. Jimmy, if you're listening, I really hope you open a donut store. I'll drive down there to Alabama and buy donuts from Junkin Donuts. Junkin, not drunken. That's where they serve the Mountain Dew.
Right.
The new Mountain Dew. So Jimmy Junkin, the manager of the city's wastewater department, said that the workers had to drain all that water. They had to sanitize the tank and get rid of debris. They didn't mention what the debris was. They also secured the hatch so that it can't happen again. And for those who are going to make the trip to see this water tank, Athens is about 25 miles northwest of Huntsville.
It's kind of scary that our drinking water is so easily accessible.
I think that was a fluke. I mean, my assumption, I could be wrong, but my assumption, I hope I'm not wrong, but my assumption is that they keep those tanks secure.
Yeah.
With, I would guess, a padlock or something.
And a big fence, and keep the weirdos away from the water I'm drinking, please.
One of our listeners, a buddy of mine, just sent me a note saying, two of my favorite topics this morning, donuts and beer. He said that. I didn't say that. I want to take a break, and we'll come right back. We'll take your phone calls. My number is 888-914-9149. Jerry Junkin, I hope you'll consider my idea. Open a donut shop, please. I'll come down there and buy donuts from you. I'll be right back.
Connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio. Don't you
forget about me. I want to say thank you to you, Pat Padovana on Twitter, who wrote to me, good morning, Patrick. Listening this morning, Mountain Dew with alcohol. Let's just make it easier for kids to drink and start the road to alcoholism. That's a very good point. I don't think it's going to be available to kids, but I get your point. My son was an alcoholic, though he passed 8 months ago from a heart attack. He had fought to the end to be sober. Oh, I'm deeply, deeply sorry. And my condolences, Pat. I can't imagine what that nightmare must have been like for you and for your son. May he rest in peace. But yes, you're raising a good point. Now, naturally, we associate Mountain Dew with kids because they can get Mountain Dew. But there's no indication that they would be able to get this kind of Mountain Dew that's spiked any more than they could get, say, a beer or a bottle of wine or something like that. So, but in any case, your point is well taken. This is part of the culture. And when kids are exposed to that early on, it can have devastating consequences. Let's go to Frank in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Good morning, Frank. Hello, Frank. You're on the air.
Cyrus?
No, this is Patrick.
Hi, Pat. I normally don't call in about this because I am an alcoholic.
Okay.
And that's not something I advertise. But I felt compelled to talk about this morning because what you were saying about this magazine that says if you have different colored eyes.
Yeah, it was Popular Science, and it said that there's no causation between the color of your eye and alcoholism, but only that they discovered there's some kind of correlation that a higher percentage of people who have alcoholism have either blue eyes or lighter colored eyes. But they made a point of saying that there's no causation one way or the other. It's just a correlation that they had never seen before.
Yeah, I've never noticed that. I've been going to meetings for over 40 years now. And I've never noticed anything like that. Someone looking in someone's eyes and see the color of their eyes doesn't make any difference. Color of your skin, your nationality, none of that makes any difference. It's just if you drink, you can become an alcoholic. And the biggest excuse I hear people say is that they were born that way. Well, that might be, but that's just an excuse.
Yeah.
You're not born an alcoholic. You choose to be an alcoholic.
I totally understand that, Frank, and I don't disagree with you. It sounds like maybe you took the article the wrong way because they were very clear that they're not suggesting that there's a genetic cause for alcoholism, certainly not with your eye color. But, you know, here's something else to think about, is that there are some groups who do have a genetic predisposition to alcoholism, namely Native Americans. It has been scientifically demonstrated that something in their genetics makes them far more susceptible to that, which is one reason why a lot of reservations, for example, have had tremendous problems with drunkenness and drunk driving and accidents. So there seems to be some genetic background there. But all I'm saying is that they notice that people with lighter colored eyes are more frequently people who have alcoholism and other issues like that. That's all.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I said again, thanks for taking my call. And I guess I understood what you were saying, but
I'm glad you called.
I guess I'll say the last is there's help out there for anyone that's still suffering.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Frank, and thank you for raising that issue. How about, let's see, let's go to Rich in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Patrick. You made a comment about water utility security, and that's piqued my interest because I worked for water utility for a short time and had a lot of conversations about this with people and others. And the fact is, until fairly recent, relatively recent, like the past 15 years or so, water utility facilities are often not secure at all. In fact,
really? You mean like those big tanks aren't padlocked or in some way, you know?
Well, they are nowadays most places, but until recently, no, they weren't. In fact, I was speaking to a young couple, said they were in a water in some place I won't name, and they climbed up a water tower just for the sake of it, and they opened up the hatch, and there was the water right there.
Oh, my.
And they're kind of amazed that they could do that. So they threw on aspirin just to sort of prove the point, and they climbed back down. And the fact is, no, there was no security. It was never given any thought. In fact, I spoke to there's one friend I had working for a water utility who told me that he used to complain about the lack of security. Hmm. And he was being told he was crazy. It was that he was insane.
So the two people in question who climbed up, in your anecdote, were not mentally ill. They were just, you know, they're out for a lark and they climbed up the tank. So that leads to my next question, Rich. I don't doubt what you're saying at all. I'm just wondering why we haven't seen people drowning in these tanks historically, because there are, I'm sure, plenty of people who have done that over the years. Maybe they're just careful when they go up there, but I could see how easy it would be to fall and die, or to fall into the tank and drown. I can't imagine.
It's just a psychological thing. Most people simply didn't think that way. It never occurred to most people. It's a very few people that even think of doing that. It's sort of a psychological barrier. And my friends who climbed the tower into the aspirin were just sort of proving a point about the lack of security. But it wasn't until 9/11 occurred that there was actually a serious thought given to infrastructure security of that sort.
Yeah.
And people don't realize how wide open we were, which kind of speaks to all of us as a society, because we had so much mutual trust in this country.
Sure. Did those people who did that, Rich, did they get in trouble with law? Because I would think that throwing an aspirin in, wouldn't that contaminate the water, or wouldn't that be considered a contamination?
Well, it's harmless because it's a tiny aspirin in a very, very large pool of water, and they did it because they knew it was harmless. They're just doing it to demonstrate, well, you can do it with an aspirin, you can do it with something else.
I see. And the police were not bothered by it.
I had no idea that happened. Nobody knew it happened. I know it happened only because they told me about it.
I see. No,
this was quite a few years ago, because we were discussing water utility security. And I was kind of appalled at the lack of it, even then.
Yeah.
But it's just that, as with many things, a lot of things go, sort of unguarded, because it doesn't occur to someone that you would anyone would do that.
I remember. Sorry to interrupt you, Rich. Go ahead.
Up until the, for example, the late 1960s, you can get on and off a commercial airplane with any kind of security. We used to go flying as a kid. There was no searching, no nothing. You just got on the plane like you got on a bus.
I remember that.
And it didn't dawn on anybody that someone might do something nasty, like bring a bomb on or try to hijack the plane.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. In fact, I remember the incident in which security changed forever. It was in California, and I don't remember now if it was a PSA Airlines flight, but there was a guy in San Diego who got fired from his job, and he was enraged about it, and he knew that his boss was going to be taking a flight from, I believe it was San Diego, up to the Bay Area, and he got on the flight with him, and he had a gun with him. And this took place, if I'm not mistaken, like in the early 1970s. And he got on the plane, killed the pilots so that the plane would crash. He shot the boss, and then he rode the plane all the way down with all those other innocent passengers in this horrible plane crash. And that's, as I understand it, what really got the attention of the federal government and the FAA, so they began implementing measures like metal detectors and things like that. Had that not happened, who knows how long it might have been before they did that. Well, Rich, thank you. I never realized that those water tanks, at least until recently, were so easily able to be opened. That's scary. Let's go to Lisa now in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Good morning, Lisa. Welcome. Hey, Lisa, you're on the air now. Welcome.
Hello.
Hey, hello.
I just wanted to say, hi, this has not happened. This happened once before in California.
What happened?
Where a young girl on top of the hotel, she climbed into a water tower, but she drowned.
Oh, horrible.
I don't know. Yeah, it was a huge story. They have it on a crime scene, like TV show right now. But she climbed in, just regular girl. They thought maybe she had some mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
But she climbed in at nighttime into a water tower that they drink, that the people in the hotel were drinking.
Oh, no.
That was their drinking water.
So they couldn't find her for a while?
You know what? I don't know how they I mean, the police found her body floating in the, I hope I'm not a spoiler for anybody who wants to watch that crime thing. But, yeah.
Now I don't want to watch it, quite honestly.
No.
What a tragedy. So they found her body in the tank, and yeah, there are all sorts of questions I don't think I want answers to, honestly.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
Because that hotel had an outbreak of TB.
Oh, TB tuberculosis?
Yes. Mm. But they didn't know that the girl, I don't know, that was their drinking water. I'm just putting things together. That was their drinking water.
I think I get the picture. That's a horrible situation.
Well, she worked in a TB lab.
Even worse. Well, so this is another example, Lisa, of why it's important to keep those things locked up so that we don't have people who are mentally ill or just out for a lark, you know, who wind up drowning or falling and getting hurt and hurting other people. So it's an odd story, the one that I shared earlier. It had a happy ending, I guess, because the lady, she survived this. But what an object lesson for the municipalities out there. At least put a padlock on these things. That way people can't get into them. Lisa, thank you. I appreciate you calling in today, and I wish you well. When we come back, excuse me, when we come back from this break, I want to share with you from Reddit some commentary from people who have read this book that I've been recommending to you on this program. The book is called Irreversible Damage. And this is by Abigail Schreier, and it's all about explaining to you what's happening in our culture right now, where especially girls, this is also happening to boys as well, but especially girls are being prodded and pushed and programmed into believing that they're actually boys. And there's a science behind what's happening. There are case studies. There's just so much information in this book, which I have bought not only a copy for myself, but I also have bought multiple copies of this book to give away as a resource to people so that they will have access to this information. And I want to share with you what some people who actually were going through this problem had to say about reading this book. It's called Irreversible Damage. I think you'll find this very interesting, especially parents. If you've got a teenage daughter or even an older age daughter who is flirting with or thinking that maybe she's trans, you need to listen to this. It's important stuff, and it's on Reddit. And I'll share that with you when we come back from this quick timeout. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio. Don't get me
wrong. That book I was telling you about, it's called Irreversible Damage, and it's by Abigail Schreier. And the book is, amazingly to me, it's still available on Amazon. It's the kind of book that you'd think would be deplatformed very quickly because they tend to try to silence people who have divergent points of view. And this book certainly presents a divergent point of view when contrasted with the the mania, as the subtitle of the book suggests, that's sweeping the country of usually parents, teachers, others who are prodding and pushing and at the very least just suggesting to young girls, you know, maybe you're not a girl, maybe you're really a boy, maybe you should consider being trans, etc. We had the story yesterday I shared with you about the little boy, 8 years old. His father lost custody of this child because the court ruled in favor of the mother, who has publicly and very vigorously promoted her intention to have this little boy, 8 years old, transition to become a girl. So this is not an isolated issue, nor is it something that you should just ignore and say, well, I don't have girls, it doesn't matter to me. Well, it'll matter to all of us soon enough. I think it does already. So just drawing from Reddit, and I want to give credit to where I saw this. I saw it on Twitter, and let me see if I have the tweet itself, because that will tell the tale. But to whoever it was that put it out there on Twitter first, thank you. I just don't have that in front of me.
Genspect.
Genspect.
At Genspect.
S-P-E-C-H-T?
G-E-N-S-P-E-C-T.
Oh, sorry about
maybe
that.
Maybe I'm probably saying it wrong.
I'm mangling the name. Okay. Well, yeah, my thanks to that person who did that by posting it. Otherwise, I would not have seen this. So here are some selections from Reddit, and I'll just start with the first one. From the ages of 14 to 17, I was chronically online. I was a tomboy, didn't have many friends, etc. I got super, super into the sort of Tumblr social justice world and convinced myself that the only explanation for my social awkwardness was that I was a transgender male. My parents were overly accepting and made sure I could get transition resources ASAP. I began my transition at age 15 after becoming convinced I was trans only about half a year prior. I started taking tea, and I presume that means testosterone, which made me feel better somewhat. I thought I could finally be one of the boys and get the social gratification that I had been longing for so long. That didn't really help, and I fell further down the Tumblr rabbit hole, becoming more and more convinced that more transition materials would make me better, and which they didn't. At age 16, I started thinking about getting top and bottom surgeries, hoping they would quell my anxieties. A little before I was going to ask my parents, however, I read Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier. I was doing this for a blog I had started running, which involved debunking things I thought to be transphobic. However, as I read more, a lot of the emotions I had been feeling started to make sense. Long story and a lot of emotional distress and panic later, I came to the conclusion that I was not trans. I decided not to get the surgeries, and I am so grateful I haven't. Slowly, I've started to get better mentally. I stopped taking testosterone. I stepped back from those radicalizing blogs I'd been reading. I had a long-term boyfriend for a while, but we recently broke up for reasons related to my transition. Testosterone, while many of the effects have gone away, has absolutely destroyed my sex drive. I hope that this can help other people who are going through similar things. Please do not be fooled that transitions are meaningless procedures. They have huge ramifications on your life. And please do not get a transition while you are under 18. Please. And you can just hear the pain. Okay, so here's another post. It's on the same Reddit thread. I thought, and this is a different person, I thought I was trans when I was 13, and I'm so glad my mom didn't take it seriously at the time. I've always been what one would describe as a huge tomboy, even as a kid. Never wore anything from the women's section. Preferred typically masculine sports and games. Cut my hair really short. You get the gist. And until I hit puberty, I was fine with that. I had no problem with who I was. When puberty came around, though, gender roles suddenly started to become more and more defined among kids my age. The girls started playing separately from the boys. People started putting pressure on me to act and look a certain way, and even my male friends that I had known for years started treating me differently from the guys in their friend groups. They stopped greeting me with a slap on the back like they greeted their male friends. They stopped wrestling me for fun. They stopped cursing around me. But I had no problem cursing around other guys, etc. And those things may seem insignificant now, but they were devastating to me at the time. My own friends were treating me differently, all because I was a girl. And I couldn't really make friends with the other girls my age either, since they actively avoided me and saw me as odd because I didn't dress or act like them. So, as you can already guess, my solution was to try to become a boy. I didn't fit the bill for femininity, so instead of accepting the fact that I was a masculine girl and a tomboy, I started calling myself transgender. I joined online communities for trans people. I read up on testosterone treatments. I even started going by a new name. Hearing people refer to me as he and young man bothered me immensely, since I still knew deep down that I was a girl. But I stuck with it because I was a clueless 13-year-old who thought that was who I was supposed to be. Throughout all this, my mom never really took my transness seriously, and I'm so grateful for that now. She didn't pressure me to be feminine in any way, and she let me do my thing. But she also made it clear that no hormone treatment or surgery or anything like that was going to happen until I was legally an adult and equipped with better decision-making skills. And after 3 long years of pretending I was a boy and calling myself transgender, I eventually came to the conclusion that it was okay to be a masculine girl, that it was okay to be myself, and that I didn't have to pretend to be someone I was not just to justify my choice of clothes and masculine hobbies. I was a girl. I was a huge tomboy, and I was happy about it. And I promised myself that I'd never again let anyone tell me how I should look, dress, or act based on my gender. And here's her conclusion. She says, I'm so glad my mom didn't take me seriously when I was just a naive 13-year-old kid, and I'm so glad I didn't end up taking any cross-sex hormones. I see so many people on here, Reddit, who started taking them at a very young age, and I'm appalled that parents took the decisions of their preteen kids so seriously. What's even more appalling, she says, is that grown adults on the online forums I was a member of were trying to groom me, a literal child, to groom me into medically transitioning to a man. Kids are highly impressionable and naive. It's something everyone knows. A 13-year-old isn't even close to having a long-term thinking capacity and the decision-making skills of an adult. I just marvel at the ability of these two young women to escape from the tentacles of this gender ideology that is wrapping itself so tightly around so many people, you know, with everything that they were up against, the peer pressure, the grooming adults trying to coax them into transitioning, quote unquote, the fact that they were able to get through that unscathed without the surgeries, because obviously once you do that, there's no going back in terms of, you know, your natural body. You maybe can get some reconstructive surgery, I suppose, but who would want that if you could avoid having to do that in the first place? I'm reminded of a website. It's called sexchangeregret.com, and it's written by, well, it's maintained by a man who was, by his own admission, he believed that he was a woman, and for years he was living as a woman, and people were using the female pronouns, etc. Sexchangeregret.com. His name is Walt Heyer. Now, when you look at his picture, and he's got pictures and videos, he's written books about this issue. He wants to help people who are maybe sliding down that slope, and they're not sure whether or not they want to go all the way or not. He wants to help people, at least the people who want to be helped. And he talks about how many people, in retrospect, wind up having deep, lifelong regrets for, quote-unquote, transitioning. And the reason I say, quote-unquote, is because you cannot transition from being a man to a woman. They'll call it that. They'll perform surgeries to sort of simulate that. Sure, you can have body parts removed to make you appear more one way or the other, but it doesn't actually change who you are. You're still a man, or you're still a woman. And, you know, God help those who are doing this to confused and impressionable, vulnerable children. So back to this weblog here, sexchangeregret.com. When you look at his pictures, you'll see that there is a kind of feminine look about him. Now, some of the pictures show him wearing women's clothing and a woman's hairstyle. Others show him as a man with a mustache and a necktie and so forth. But when you see him, you could see how there is a kind of feminine side to him and a masculine side to him. But he's a man biologically. And since he's been down this road before and he understands what's going on, and he's been in touch with so many people whose lives have been ruined and deeply regret the decisions that they made when they were young and vulnerable and susceptible to other people promoting this kind of thing, that too is another resource that I would encourage you to share with your son or daughter or somebody else who comes to you for advice, because this way you can say, well, look at what this person's experience was. Here's what he says in the About Me section. He says, I was a transgender woman for 8 years. My name is Walt Heyer, and in April of 1983, I had gender reassignment surgery. At first, I was giddy for the fresh start, but hormones and sex change genital surgery couldn't solve the underlying issues driving my gender dysphoria. I detransitioned, he says, more than 25 years ago. I learned the truth. Hormones and surgery may alter appearances, but nothing changes the immutable fact of your sex. So if you're interested, that is a resource that's available to you. And I have tremendous, it's hard for me to put this into words, but I have tremendous compassion and empathy for people who are going through this. I myself have never had to worry about that. I've never been bothered by any such thing like that. But apparently many people are. And we need to love them and care for them and especially show them the love of Jesus, because he loves them too. But you can't do that adequately if you don't have tools at your disposal, if you don't have information and knowledge. And it may not be native information to you, but you can always point to people like Walt Heyer, who has the experience, and the other people associated with him who had these experiences, and you can rely upon their experience to try to help other people. So in the process of trying to be loving and compassionate with people who are dealing with this very serious issue, prepare yourself. So that book by Abigail Schreier again, Irreversible Damage, get it. I encourage you, get it. I benefit in no way from this. She doesn't even know me. I don't know her. She doesn't know me. But the book is that important, and the problem is that big that it's one of those things where down the road you might kick yourself and say, oh, if only I'd read that book, if only I had given somebody a copy of that book or this website, etc. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, I think we have a little audio by Walt Heyer. Is that right?
Yeah, this is from the main page on
sexchangeregret.com.
Okay. That's right. And so this is Walt, and I think this is worth playing.
Yeah, let's play it.
Hi, I'm Walt Heyer. I started my transgender journey when I was 4 years old. I was being cross-dressed by my grandmother, and as a result of that, I struggled with my identity all the way through my life, and I eventually underwent gender reassignment surgery, lived 8 years as Laura Jensen until I found the Lord Jesus Christ, who redeemed and restored my life. I started sexchangeregret.com because I really wanted to find out if I was the only one that had regret. We had 350,000 people come to the website in 12 months, and I knew then that this was huge. Most of the people, regret doesn't occur until 5 to 15 years after. So we're looking at the people's lives early on, 2 and 3 and 4 years after they had the surgery, and report success. But we don't talk about these individuals 20 years later that wants to commit suicide. There'd probably be many more of them coming out like I am, except they've committed suicide. They died. The Lord wants the transgender community in the church. The Lord wants them to hear the truth, that something happened to them that was horrible. But the only way to really escape pain in your life is turn it over to Jesus Christ so that the pain goes away. You know, it's never too late to be redeemed and restored by Jesus Christ.
That just gets you, doesn't it? And do you hear the compassion in his voice? He's not angry. He's not strident. He's not attacking. He's not condemning. He's not dismissing. All the things that I'm certain were done to him by the people who just absolutely cannot abide the possibility that somebody would take a stand like that against the transgender ideology. You hear the compassion in his voice. You can see it. You can watch this video, sexchangeregret.com. Bookmark it, because you might need it someday. You might have a daughter or a niece or a granddaughter or somebody who needs this. So be aware of that. We have to take a break. We're going to come back and do phone calls here in just a minute. But when you have time, take a look at this website. And then the book, again, that I mentioned by Abigail Schreier, it's called Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze That's Destroying Our Daughters. So that's those are two resources now that you've got at your disposal. We're going to take phone calls. Has this situation affected you or a daughter or a son or somebody that you deeply care about and you're just not sure what to do? Give me a call. We'll talk about it. The number is 888-914-9149. You can call the show now. We'll get you on the air. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Yes, Iris.
If you have kids that are watching TikTok and on social media, this affects your family.
Absolutely.